Okay, this is the hour. We'll take your phone calls with Dr. Ralph Moss, Ph.D., as we talk about doctored results and the cancer industry next on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back. Dr. Ralph Moss with us. Ralph, of all these years of trying to battle cancer, we are still faced with chemotherapy and radiation as what they use primarily. How can that be?
Yeah, well, that's the problem when you don't allow free innovation. When you squelch innovation, you wind up with the same old, same old. And that's what we have. I'm not saying that people shouldn't utilize these things, surgery, radiation, chemo, but they have their place, and they've certainly collectively, especially surgery, saved many lives. But we need to move much more rapidly into other areas, because the prospect of being cured of stage 4 cancer, which is what's going to kill about half the people who get cancer in the United States, that still as bad as it was pretty much for the cancers as it was 40 years ago. So where have all the billions and billions and billions of dollars that have been poured into cancer research gone? If you still do the same old stuff over and over again, you're going to get the same old solutions. And I'm not terribly optimistic about the so-called targeted drugs or the genetic treatments, which we could talk about, or even about the latest round of immune therapy, although I think there's been some progress made there in manipulating the immune system. But the way they do it is too toxic, mm-hmm. too toxic to be used, and it's going to fall on its face out of just the sheer toxicity of it.
What do you think of stem cell injections into tumors?
Well, I'm a little leery of it, because stem cells, if you take ordinary stem cells and inject it into a mouse, you create a tumor. So I'd have to know, you know, really exactly what and why they were doing that. Is it just something that's a kind of a popular slogan, or is it something that really can be demonstrated to have effectiveness? And the little bit of clinical research I've seen isn't terribly convincing. So I don't think, to me, the things that make sense are leaving aside the areas where chemotherapy definitely does work, and there are some, but a combination of heat therapy and immune therapy in combination, I think, is very promising, with judicious small amounts of chemotherapy sometimes added in. And I've seen this be quite successful even in stage 4 disease. So as I say, that can't be done in the United States, not with the current attitude of the Food and Drug Administration. Food and Drug Administration has only approved heat therapy or hypothermia for one kind of cancer. You possibly could get away with treating one other kind of cancer with it, or two others. Mm-hmm. But basically, they demand a clinical trial for every indication of cancer. Now, it costs a couple of million dollars to do that clinical trial, and about 5 years to work, to actually finish the trial. So given the fact that there is, let's say, 125 kinds of cancer, and there's 4 stages for each cancer, that's 500 indications right there. And if it takes 5 years, you're talking about 2,500 years before you'll be able to say that cancer is allowed to be treated with hypothermia or heat therapy across the board in the United States. That's a pretty long time. I mean, 40 years feels like a very long time to be waiting for something definitive to happen around cancer. You remember that when the Cancer Act was signed by President Nixon in December of 1971, it was publicly stated that the goal of the War on Cancer, or the National Cancer Act, was to find a cure for cancer in time for the American Bicentennial. So July 1976 was supposed to be the latest point mm-hmm. in which they would find a cure for some major kinds of cancer. Well, of course, I went back to the Journal of the National Cancer Institute in July of 1976. There wasn't even a mention made of the promise that they were going to cure cancer in 5 years. But that was the original premise that they made and promise that they made when they sold us on this idea of the so-called war on cancer. Give us the money, give us $1 billion a year and we'll lick cancer, as the head of MD Anderson Cancer Center said. So we gave them $1 billion a year and nothing happened.
Jeez.
And then we gave them $20 billion a year
and nothing happened.
And that's the way it's gone. And then, yeah, you know, it becomes sacrosanct. No politician, I mean, can stand up against this, because the public has been sold on the idea that all we need to do is keep pouring more and more money into this cancer war, and that's what is the problem. The problem, in my opinion, isn't the money, that there's a lack of money. The problem is that the money isn't going towards the most productive areas and or to the brightest people. And when they come up with something, against all odds, when a really good scientist comes up with something really exciting, it's deep sixed. I mean, it's just ignored or unappreciated, or it's attacked from every angle. And once something is attacked, it becomes quote-unquote controversial. And if it's controversial, nobody wants to touch it. And I found when I worked as an advisor to the National Institutes of Health, which took up the better part of 9 or 10 years for me, that they would look at everything except for the thing that was the most important and most promising things, and the things that were so-called controversial treatments that they couldn't touch. And if you tried to get them to, you became persona non grata at the NIH, and they just didn't want to have any part of you because you were insisting that they do the very thing that they didn't want to do, which is to seriously examine the controversial ideas.
Is cancer simply a mutant cell that replicates and grows?
It's a cell that won't die. I mean, normally cells have a mechanism. They grow old and they die, and then they're cut up for body parts, as it were, the so-called apoptosis or programmed cell death. But the cancer cell has, for whatever reason, has lost the ability to hear the signal that it's time for it to recycle itself and be used by all the other cells for the chemicals inside the cell. And so it starts to grow, and then it has the ability, for reasons that can be, you know, could be discussed. I mean, it's rather long discussion of why it is that cancer cells can metastasize or go from one organ to another organ, but that's the most deadly aspect of cancer. It isn't the fact that the cancer exists. I mean, cancers could be removed surgically, or if they're growing very slowly, they could be left in place and not to be worried about, but it's this potential for jumping to other vital organs and shutting them down.
That's right.
Through their interference with the, you know, with the normal processes of that organ. That's what makes it dangerous. That's why Laetrol was so exciting. Laetrol was the most powerful, most effective agent for stopping the spread of cancer that they had investigated up to that point. And if there are more effective and not relatively non-toxic agents available today, they're not known to me. I mean, yes, aspirin, as I said, or non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs may have that potential as well. Low cost, relatively non-toxic, although more toxic than Laetrol, and seemingly very effective in some preliminary studies. So I don't want to say Laetrol is necessarily the best drug ever discovered for controlling cancer, but it certainly was the best drug ever discovered up until that point, and they killed it.
And what do you think of
is that Doctored Results is about, and that's what Eric Marola's film Second Opinion is about. They killed it.
What do you think of turmeric, Ralph?
Yes, turmeric has curcumin in it, and I'm very familiar with the work of Bharat Agarwal at MD Anderson, mm-hmm, Cancer Center. Outstanding work, showing that turmeric and the most active ingredient, curcumin, has a profound anti-inflammatory effect in the human body. I've used it myself for a very stubborn inflammatory condition that I had, and after I went to visit him in Houston, I got so inspired, I went home and I started taking it, and it had very, very positive effects for me personally. So I believe in it, and again, we're talking about pennies. I mean, this is the most widely used, one of the most widely used spices in India, turmeric. It's what we use in the United States. We use to color mustard yellow, mm-hmm. and it's the main ingredient in curry powder. But you'd have to take a lot of curry powder to get the concentrated medical effect. So the curcumin is just I think it's 4% of the turmeric plant is curcumin, and they just simply derive that and take it as a pill. And it can be very effective anti-inflammatory. Whatever is anti-inflammatory, as I said, inflammation is the seedbed for cancer. So if it's anti-inflammatory, we can presume that it has some merit in terms of making cancer less likely.
All right, let's go to the phones now. We'll pick it up by going to Lewistown, New York. Jill is with us on Coast to Coast. Jill, welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi. I just wanted to ask if there's any promising studies on marijuana and ESIAC, which is by a nurse, Renee Casey, in New Brunswick. A guy was curing marijuana or curing cancer with marijuana, and the RCMP shut him down. And I've heard oxygen therapy or MMS can help with cancer. And the what I'm wondering is, you know, really, chemotherapy is extremely toxic and damaging to the immune system. And, I mean, they give this to animals in universities and children. I mean, couldn't this be under legally be considered animal cruelty and child abuse?
Oh, I don't know about that, but what do you think of cannabis and cancer?
Yeah, it's promising. When I went to Israel, I was really astonished at, first of all, the amount of research they were doing on cannabis in cancer. And then they told me at Hadassah Hospital, which is like the Sloan Kettering of Israel, that they give cannabis to all the children with cancer, cannabis THC or cannabis derivatives at the hospital. So where there are countries where there are no taboos or less taboos about the use of marijuana, then there's freer research. I think the research has been held up in the United States because of the extreme difficulty of doing research on this forbidden substance. That said, I did look at this recently, and I think there are some individual cases that bear further investigation where people may have been put in remission. But you know what happens when you forbid something? You also create a rumor mill around it. And what I'm seeing mostly around cannabis and cancer is a rumor mill, people claiming benefit. But you know, the average person doesn't always get the story right. In other words, sometimes they've done other things that could also account for the remission of cancer, or they could, it's a fine art to be able to take a case and fairly evaluate it in order to be able to say definitively that the remission of cancer, if it occurred because of the particular substance that was used and not some other substance. So I'd be cautious in making decisions based upon stories that you see on YouTube, because they're really not scientifically presented, and there's a lot to be said for the scientific method in deciding whether or not something was beneficial or not. And even that just becomes the basis for a clinical trial. I forget the other parts of the lady's question, but no, I don't think it's child abuse to give chemotherapy to a child. Because the cancers that children get are remarkably responsive to chemotherapy and radiation. It's a brutal treatment, and we need better treatments without a doubt. And what I'm suggesting is, you know, across the board, a greater investigation of the methods that are already being used in European clinics and Chinese clinics and Mexican clinics to treat cancer in a less harsh and less toxic way. But at this point, if a child has, let's say, acute lymphocytic leukemia, it would be very foolish to and illegal to deny that child the chemotherapy, because there's a very good chance that the child will be cured by the chemotherapy. A disease that was uniformly fatal within the lifetimes of some of the older people listening now is mostly cured in a high percentage of cases. So no, I definitely don't think it would be cruelty to children. But at a certain point, if the child is no longer responding to the conventional treatment, then I think it's perfectly legitimate and, in fact, necessary to offer them some of the less proven treatments, or at least allow them to get some of the less proven treatment, as has happened with the children with brain cancer who have gone to Dr. Stanislaw Brzezinski in Houston, Texas. I think it's appropriate. If there really is very little prospect of cure after other treatments have failed, then why not allow them to use treatments that are outside the box, and that way they get the relief of at least knowing they've tried something else that may cure their child, and science gets the benefit of seeing what happens in such cases. And sometimes the outcomes have been very interesting and even quite remarkable. So I think we need to lighten up on the way that we demand that people only do chemo alone, even in children. There should be a kind of like in Canada, there's a sliding scale. In other words, as the child grows up, gets to have more and more of a say in what treatment they're going to be given. And in the U.S., it's like till you're 18, you're like under the complete control of the state in terms of the treatment. You can't have any say whatsoever, and I think that's wrong. But essentially, I would say there are ways of giving chemotherapy that make the chemotherapy less toxic and more effective, and those involve the integration, as we were talking about earlier, of non-toxic, non-conventional treatments into the conventional regimen.
Ralph, isn't it true that we all have cancer cells in our bodies? It's just that some of us are more immune at the point to stop it?
That's possible. It's possible. That was an old theory of
the old wives' tale, huh?
Well, I don't know about a wives' tale, but it's never been proven. I mean, I think that, let's just say, you know, we know that certain cancers occur, like prostate cancer is very common in older people. I have a feeling that when all is said and done, you're going to see a lot of convergence of the research on diabetes with the research on cancer.
That's interesting. Hold on for a second, Ralph. We're going to come back. We'll talk more with you and take final calls on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast AM. On our next program, split show for the first couple hours, we're going to talk about the oil card, then followed by June DeYoung and her thoughts about after-death experiences. So make sure you're part of that show. And when we come back in a moment with our dear guest, Dr. Ralph Moss, we will take your final phone calls on Coast to Coast AM. Welcome back with Ralph Moss. Ralph, we were talking about if everybody is carrying cancer cells in their body. And yeah, you say, well, hasn't been proven yet, but what do you think of that?
Well, I think we all have the potential to form cancer, and mm-hmm. but we do have immune systems, and I also think that the diabetes epidemic, the epidemic of obesity and diabetes and pre-diabetes, is setting the stage for cancer, because cancers are, as I said earlier, avid consumers of glucose or sugar, and so when you maintain a high level of glucose in the blood, which is the working definition of diabetes or prediabetes, you're really creating an environment in which cancer can thrive. And so these two big problems that we have in our society of diabetes and blood sugar control and cancer are related in surprising ways. And this is recognized at the level of the National Institutes of Health. They have a special program, actually, to investigate this issue. So it is something that's gotten some attention, but I think it's part of the bigger picture of why we have so many millions of people coming down with cancer. Their blood is actually fostering or allowing for the development, because it's soaking any cell that becomes cancerous in a solution that is very conducive to its growth.
Ralph, do you distrust mainstream medicine, pharmaceuticals?
No, I don't. I mean, I use mainstream medicine in my own life. So, in fact, I just went to the doctor today. So I have a healthy respect and regard for mainstream medicine. I certainly believe in the scientific method. Most of my waking days are spent investigating, you know, scientific papers, reading thousands and thousands of scientific papers. And so I have a reverence for the scientific method and a great respect for doctors and what they go through, and even, you know, oncologists, how difficult their lives are and their professional careers are. It's a very difficult disease, and nobody has a simple answer to this. I just would like to see things opened up a lot more. And at the federal level, I think that the government should allow people to have access to a broad array of non-conventional treatments, especially those that have already been identified in other countries as beneficial, such as heat therapy and immune therapy, and Laetrile too. But I think the main thing with Laetrile is to do the research, because the suppression of Laetrile over the past 40 years has left a great glaring gap, and the number of researchers, I mean, you'd have to be extremely dedicated or even a little foolhardy at this point. If you were a young scientist and you said to your supervisor, your boss, your lab head, I think I'm going to start investigating Laetrile and other cyanide-containing compounds from fruit kernels, I mean, they would tell you you're crazy. I mean, that would be like career suicide to do something like that. So we have to remove the stigma that surrounds Laetrile and get the research going again, pick up again, not to reproduce Dr. Segura's results at Sloan Kettering, because I think in my book, Doctored Results, I make a convincing case that his results were highly positive and really never were refuted. The so-called refutation was a joke. So we need to pick this up again. And by the way, towards this end, Eric Marola, the man who produced the Second Opinion film that I, quote-unquote, star in, he and I and some supporters are going to leaflet Sloan Kettering on this coming Thursday at noon in New York City, outside the main entrance to Sloan Kettering. We'll be handing out a new edition of the newsletter Second Opinion that I edited 35 years ago. So we've sort of picked up the thread. And the purpose of this is to wake up the employees and the scientists and the researchers at Sloan Kettering, and especially the top administration and the trustees, that this issue hasn't gone away. It'll never go away as long as the truth is not acknowledged about what happened. Sooner or later, this is going to become, you know, come to the fore again, because as I said, it was the best agent for controlling metastases that had ever been discovered up until that point, and very few others have been discovered since then. So we want to get out there, not in an antagonistic way, but in a friendly, cooperative way to leaflet them, because we don't know any other way to reach them, to let them know that this issue is still alive. We're not saying that they need to start treating people with Laetrile. We're just in favor of picking up the research in a sympathetic way that can bring out the best within Laetrile, as the German scientists are doing right now, as the Spaniards are doing, as people around the world in China and Korea are also doing. So we want to, you know, get out there, and if anybody who's listening wants to join us, we'd be thrilled to have you come to the main entrance to Memorial Sloan Kettering, which is 1275 York Avenue in New York City, on Thursday at noon, when we're going to start handing out these leaflets again.
Okay, let's go to the calls now. First-time caller, Don, truck driving in Missouri. Thanks for calling, Don. Go ahead. Don, you with us?
Yes.
Yeah,
there
you go.
Thank you for taking my call, George.
Sure thing.
I had a comment there. Years ago, the Hindu Indians, they prized herself off of their apricot trees. That's all they had.
Yeah.
They ate the apricot seed, the apricot and the seed. They had no reported cases of cancer. They had a longer lifespan. And they, later, as they become to where they got out a lot more and changed their diets, they began to get a few reported cases of cancer. There is more... more people make a living off cancer than what dies of cancer. And
that's right.
And people that have a high level of vitamin B17 in their system does not get cancer, or not near as often, I shall say, okay, as what I've told. And once more, what does it say in the Bible? For I have given you every tree-bearing fruit with the yielding seed.
I believe that.
For this shall be your meat. You shall eat the fruit and the seed. Right? And this Laetrile, I've studied on that, and I don't know what you think of it, but there's a book, A World Without Cancer, and it's really opened my eyes a whole lot on it.
Most early societies, regardless of what kind of diet they ate, had very little cancer, very little heart disease, and diabetes was almost unknown. I mean, it was known in the ancient world, but very rare. So I think we need to look at what have we done to our environment and to our diet in the past few hundred years, and particularly in the past 100 years. And when you look at that, the thing that jumps out most at me is the excess consumption of refined carbohydrates, sugar, and flour, and seed oils that were never in part of the human diet before, and hydrogenated oils. I mean, we've messed with our traditional ways of eating without any increase in our health. The largest human experiment ever conducted is the one of basically calling for a low-fat diet and a high carbohydrate diet among all Americans. And we've seen what happened. 75% of the people over the age of 70 now have diabetes or pre-diabetes. And many younger people do. You see incredible amounts of obesity. And it isn't just because of inactivity. It's, in my opinion, because of the high intake of the fructose, high fructose corn syrup, the sugar that's in almost everything. You can't get away from it. And the refined flour, and then on top of that, more and more people having these sedentary jobs. But something's going on in terms of the metabolism, and if you look at, let's say, the Eskimo or the Maasai people in Africa or the Mongolians, a friend of mine at Dartmouth College did a study on the Mongolians and found that even though they have very little medical care, and they eat mostly meat and fatty meat at that, they have one-eighth the amount, the women have one-eighth the amount of breast cancer as American women do, and one-fourth the death rate from breast cancer, even though they only have one hospital in their major city. So eating your natural diet, the diet that of your ancestors, is a lot healthier than eating newfangled diets that we really, you know, don't really know what the effects are and that appear to be quite harmful. I don't think it's just the B17, because plenty of people around the world don't get B17 in their diet, and yet they maintain good health. Like the Mongolians, I asked my friend at the college whether she had been there and she had studied this, whether they ate any form of Laetrile, and she couldn't think of any. So I don't think you need to eat the apricot kernels, despite what Mr. Griffin says in his book, A World Without Cancer, but the natural diet of our ancestral diets are the ones that kept us healthy. And now that we've switched to this high carbohydrate diet, we're seeing a lot of ill effects, including very high rates of cancer.
Let's go to Denver and Jackson, Mississippi. Denver, thanks for holding so long. Go ahead.
Yeah, thank you, George. I'd like to express a little research I've done. My research shows me that a lot of doctors have been killed and lost their license for trying to come out with a cure for cancer. And I'm very aware of Dr. Mary's monkey. That's about that experiment that went on at Tulane University back in the 40s to spread mm-hmm. cancer throughout the country, especially in the South. Could you elaborate on that a little bit, sir?
Did you ever check into that? It's an interesting theory of some atrocities that occurred at Tulane University.
And, Tulane.
There's a new book out now on that, and we had them on
as a guest. I'll look into it. I don't know how you would spread cancer. How would they spread cancer? You can't inject cancer into a person.
And thank God it's not airborne, is it?
It's not airborne. You can't inject it. It would be just rejected. They tried. There were experiments done in the 1940s in New York where they injected people in who were in nursing homes with cancer cells. This was done at Sloan Kettering, but the cancer wouldn't take. You can't just inject the cancer into another person. So I don't know how that could possibly be.
Let's go to Daniel in Ann Arbor. Yeah, check into that. Go ahead, Daniel. Good to have you with us.
George, Dr. Moss.
Hi.
Hi. Have you guys mentioned the Binzel testing protocol for B17 maintenance levels in the blood devised by Dr. Binzel?
Well, I knew Dr. Binzel.
Okay. Dr. Philip Binzel, a doctor who used Laetrile
in Ohio, wasn't he?
In Ohio, he came up with a precise blood test, which is one of the lesser used but readily available blood panel tests on that standard list of blood tests whose boxes your doctor checks off. What he found in general was that if you could maintain exactly between 1.2 and 2.5 milligrams per deciliter, the modern test multiplies by that by 10, so it's 12 to 25. That is the perfect level of B17 to have in your blood as a maintenance level. It takes it out of the realm of guesswork, and it takes it into the realm of exact science. All you have to do is take more or less B17 to determine how much your particular bio-individual body is absorbing and retaining. If you keep between 1.2 and 2.5, that's ideal. Over the last 10 years, with the help of Dr. Morse, my wife has dealt with stage 4 breast cancer, never had chemotherapy, never had radiation, minimal therapy, and she has used this test every 3 months, along with a tumor marker. She has never strayed between 1.2 and 2.5, and today her lilies this summer were the best ever in her garden. She was supposed to be dead 10 years ago. But this protocol designed by Dr. Binzel is because thiocyanate is the natural metabolite of B17. If this metabolite level is in the desired target range of 1.2 to 2.5 or 10 to 25, you're golden.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. Yeah.
He wrote it up in his book called Alive and Well, which was published by Geoward Griffin's American Media. And on page 100 of that book, he talks about that. A very cooperative physician basically for the last 10 years has been checking off a check of her tumor marker and the thiocyanate test, and every time when the result comes back, as long as it's between 1.2 or 2.5, as it drops towards 1.2, she takes more. As it hits 2.5, she takes less.
I like very that test. That's fascinating. What's also fascinating, Ralph, is so many people out there trying to find these cures. They seem to be circling the wagons, but they're just not there yet.
Right. Well, what I see happening is great ideas being developed out of basic research, and then it dies on the vine. Because if you can't come up with a blockbuster drug, they're not interested. That's the basic pattern. I talked about this in Cancer Industry in 1980. I talk about it in Doctored Results this year. Eric Morola talks about it in Second Opinion, and I've heard this from dozens and dozens of scientists. They have great ideas. I mean, this business of the taking the anti-inflammatory drugs after surgery could save thousands of lives, but the person who has been trying at Harvard, who's been trying to promote this, has gotten nowhere. He's in complete frustration because even though it would take a relatively small amount of money to prove the case, if you took women who had just been operated on and gave them anti-inflammatory drugs while they were, you know, around the time of their operation, there's no interest. He can't find any funding for this. And we've got people in Germany who are ready to do clinical trials on Laetrile, and we need the funding through a foundation in order to do that. And I think that I could help these people get the funding. But when you're not dealing with a blockbuster, so a blockbuster is a drug that makes $1 billion a year. There's one drug, a cancer drug, Avastin, that last year made $6.2 billion. That's bigger than the gross domestic product.
See, they can't just make that, Ralph. They can't make that with the natural stuff. Thanks for being on the program. Ralph Moss's websites are all linked up at coasttocoastam.com. For Jeff DeRay, Dan Galante, Tom Danheiser, Lisa Lyon, Lex Lonehood, Sean Laudasour, Stephanie Smith, Chris Boros, George Napinard Bell, I'm George Norrie, somewhere out there on Coast to Coast AM. We'll see you on our next edition. Until then, be safe, everyone.